Welcome to Disruptive Successor, a show for next generation leaders in family businesses and entrepreneurs who want to disrupt the status quo and take their existing business to a whole new level. We all know that what got us here isn't going to get us there. This show will provide inspiration, advice, and resources to help you create massive impact.
This podcast is sponsored by myself, Jonathan Goldhill, and my company, The Goldhill Group, where we provide coaching for growing companies. I'm Jonathan Goldhill, and my purpose is simple: to guide entrepreneurial leaders in family businesses towards more freedom and fulfillment. I want entrepreneurs to get clarity around the changes that will make them and their businesses more successful so they can experience the same freedom I've enjoyed in my life. Our proven practices challenge business owners to think differently about their business and how they're running it, and quite literally become game changers in our clients' companies. Learn more at thegoldhillgroup.com website, where you can schedule your free strategy session. Jonathan Goldhill here, and welcome back to another episode of the Disruptive Successor Show. Today, my guest is Doug Stone. Doug actually is someone that I grew up with, and 40 years later, here we are just getting reacquainted. Doug cut his career with Roger Fisher, the Harvard Law professor and director of the Harvard Negotiation Project. Roger Fisher, you might know, was the co-author of the best-selling book, Getting to Yes, Negotiating Agreement Without Giving In. Doug himself, though, is a co-author of Difficult Conversations and teaches negotiation and conflict resolution at Harvard Law School. He is also the founder of the consulting firm Triad Consulting Group, which specializes in corporate education, leadership, and communication. So in today's podcast, we're going to talk about communications when there are differences and the stakes are high. What are the tools that are available to you in these situations to use to get to the other side, and how to talk about things that are hard to talk about? It's so important to talk to people who see things differently from you, and you have to do it in a different way. But how? And I think this is one of the most difficult areas for family businesses. And so, Doug, I want to welcome you to the show today so we can talk about these issues for our listeners.
Hey, Jonathan, it's great to see you and really nice to be on the show. Do your listeners know about your basketball playing prowess? When we were kids, Jonathan was a terror on the basketball court. Nice jump shot, very, very good driving to the hoop.
And I specialized in like those basketball moves that you, the fake, the double pump, because that was all razzle dazzle New York Knicks growing up, like trying to be.
For 40 years later, I still remember falling for those. You had a serious head fake.
I had a serious head fake. Well, Doug, it didn't help me 40 years later when dealing with the affairs of my mother, who passed a couple of years ago. And I found myself in a family business, if you will. Mostly I have a brother and a sister. My brother completely checked out from dealing with any of the affairs and said, you two handle it. And my sister and I, we had a lot of challenges getting on the same page with each other. And here I am, a coach to family businesses and recognizing that this is very similar to what a lot of businesses go through when they have trouble getting on the same page and gaining agreement with each other. So I know this is your body of work. I'd like to talk about, why don't you give just the listeners a little bit of background about what you do, what maybe, what's the typical type of engagement or client, if you've got one in the family business space, what that looks like. Just so people understand your street cred.
Yeah. And we can come back to your example with your sister, which is common, sadly common that we all experience challenges with people who are close to us. So my background is I went to Harvard Law School and I met Professor Roger Fisher, who was a pioneer in teaching the subject of negotiation at a time when Nobody thought that was really a subject. And it just seemed like a much better way to resolve conflicts than fighting, going to war, suing, all the sort of typical power options. And I was very attracted to this idea that you could just sit down, negotiate, not always successfully, but sometimes. And the better, the more skill you bring to it, the more likely you are, if it's a negotiation, the more likely you are to get a good deal for yourself. If it's a conflict, the more likely you are to kind of manage the conflict in an ongoing way that supports the relationship. So that, like, compared to suing people or doing, you know, other kinds of law, that was very appealing and it felt very constructive to me. And so I just followed in his path. My contribution was the topic of difficult conversations, which is what you and I are talking about today. And it's difficult conversations are really anything that feels like it's hard to talk about, whether it could be a big thing or a small thing. But the family, businesses, and entrepreneurs, and just anytime a group of people have sort of close ties, like a family, and also are in business together, it's like a perfect storm of intensity in terms of the kinds of misunderstandings you can have. When it goes well, it can be amazing, but it's so easy for conflicts to arise. And they're really inevitable. They're inevitable in any family, any relationship, any business. What's not inevitable is sort of what direction it goes in. So the more skill you can bring to it, the more likely it is that you'll be able to manage it in some useful way.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a real challenge. I like to talk about what some of the skills and tools that are available. Because I know that I've used a tool in my career that I think has been really helpful. It's probably been taken from the Crucial Conversations author. And it's framed up in a way so that you can cover all the bases. I think it's very similar probably to your tool as well, which, by the way, folks, is available from Doug on his website, right? They can go and download some of these tools for communication. They'll be in the show notes, so look for them there. But I think part of the problem is identifying the area of disagreement, and maybe the bigger problem is the willingness to want to speak about it. It's not always that both parties want to speak about it. I always feel like, well, one party wants to talk about it, but the other one doesn't want to talk about it, and so you get into this maybe stonewalling behavior by one party. That would be one example of a situation or type of behavior in a situation. It makes it really difficult to have a conversation.
Yeah, well, that's for sure. I mean, if someone really is set on not talking about something, you can't usually force them to, but there are ways, a couple things to do that help are you can make a standing offer. Like, you know, I invite you to discuss this with me. People tend to be more receptive to an invitation than to a demand.
Yep.
But another thing you can do is let them know the impact that the dispute is having on you. So sometimes people will be like, I don't want to talk about it, and everything is fine. And so sometimes we need to say, look, I want to talk about it, and it's not a small thing. To me, this is a big thing. Like, to me, this impacts the viability of our relationship or the viability of our business. You know, I can't make you talk about it, but I do want to make sure that when you're thinking about whether you should engage or not, you know that this is like a serious thing that we're talking about.
Well, I'm facing this with one of my clients right now where there's a parent and a child, and the child is running the business, and the parent is basically using the business which he started as a piggy bank, if you will. He's pulling money out on a regular basis, more money than than he's really earning, or that even the business in some time cases is throwing off. And it's putting the child who's running the business as the president CEO at a disadvantage. And I keep saying, look, you know, you have to say to yourself, like, what's your ultimatum? You have to give him an ultimatum if you can't get him to pay attention, if he's stonewalling. And if he's stonewalling, you know, people stonewall for different reasons. In this case, I just think there's a little bit of, I mean, sometimes I've seen it, there's dementia, sometimes there's just ADHD, sometimes there's, I'm not talking about that, and it's just, it's too uncomfortable. There's a lot of reasons. But
absolutely.
But you have to know what your yes is basically my point. Like, you have to be able to say, like, I say yes to me, and this is what I'm willing to accept or do as a, and I need to let people, someone know, like, that's my ultimatum.
You know, it's really a great point. So in my field, we talk a lot of, so my field in sort of conflict resolution, negotiation, communication, we talk a lot about listening and empathy, but we also talk about assertiveness, right? Because if you and I are having a difficult conversation, and I'm doing all the listening and I'm empathizing, which is great, that might move us along. But there's a point in the conversation, we're not going to have an effective, useful conversation if I'm not willing to say what's important to me. I can't just, you know, land this conversation successfully with empathy and listening. And so if you've tried to engage the other person in all the best ways that you know how, and they really refuse to engage, there's a point at which it's important to be clear in the ways that you're talking about. Like, you, what you don't want is to say, well, so anyway, you wouldn't talk with me, so I quit the business. And then the other person says, well, I didn't know you were going to quit. Like, if I'd known that, I would have talked to you. So you want to, after you've tried all the ways to engage with them, yeah, you want to clarify exactly. So if we continue not to talk, here's what that's going to mean in terms of, you know, here's what's going to happen. I'm going to leave, or I'm going to redesign. I'm going to take the business in a different direction, or I'm going to close your bank account, or whatever it is. You want to describe the consequences of them choosing not to talk so that they can make a totally informed choice.
Well, I think it's interesting because, you know, to one person, the stakes might be really high, but to the other person, the stakes might not be high at all.
In their perception. One of the things that I say, it's like in marriage counseling, if one person thinks there's a problem in the marriage, then there's a problem in the marriage. Doesn't matter what the second person thinks.
Correct. It's true.
And so if something is really important to one person and it's not important to the other person, it's important to the relationship. But the person who doesn't think that it's important hasn't understood that yet. But, you know, they might if someone explains it in clear language.
So do you think that the person who has little awareness, either intuitively or intellectually, about what we're talking about, are they tending to use certain approaches to difficult conversations? Like, one person might be an influencer, a persuader. And so that's their only sort of tool in their tool belt, is to try and come in and persuade. And if they, you know, that's what they lead with, that's what they finish with, that's their middle game as well. I mean, that's a difficult situation.
Yeah, exactly. So we all have different strengths and challenges. And somebody like you're describing, let's assume they've been successful in life. They've become successful with those skills, right? So they have a lot of information about themselves that says, this is how I do it. And when I do it this way, it works. The problem is, it's not working in this situation by definition, if the other person feels like, oh, it's not, this is not working well. So the question is, how do you engage that in a way that, you know, you could sort of match, like, they threaten you, you could threaten them back. Mm-hmm. One really useful tool is what we call the three positions. And it's just three perspectives on how to think about a problem or a conversation. Okay. And the first perspective is, like, if you and I are having a difficult conversation, position one is how I see things from my point of view. Mm-hmm. And so that has to do with, like, do I know what I want? Am I being assertive in the right ways? The kind of things you were talking about before. Position two is, how does Jonathan see it? What does he want in this conversation? Mm-hmm. And you know, those two are kind of well-known, like there's my point of view, your point of view. What we tend to do less often and certainly less intuitively is what we call the third position, which is not my position, not your position, but a position outside, if we had a mutual friend, mm-hmm. who was, you know, neutral as to this conflict, they would look at the conflict as a third person and they would have a really different angle on it. And that can be really helpful. So you could approach a person who's kind of heavy-handed or bosses people around, and instead of saying, look, let's have a conversation about the fact that I don't like the way you manage things. That would be from first position, right? Mm-hmm. Or I could say, let's have a conversation about the fact that, you know, you have trouble with various things that I'm doing in the business. Mm-hmm. And that would be from your point of view. And those would seem to be the usual choices, like start with my point of view or start with your point of view. But a really useful tool is starting with this third position. And you could say, you know, you and I have different management skills. This is my observation, is this is the way that you manage things. I approach things from a different angle. That's creating some conflict. Let's talk about that. So I'm not starting the conversation by saying, this is a conversation where you're bad and you're at fault. Let's talk about that, because you're going to be defensive about that. I'm not starting saying, this is a conversation where I'm bad and I'm at fault. Let's talk about that. That'll make me defensive. I'm starting by describing it almost the way our third party friend would describe it and say, hey, Jonathan, Doug, you guys each have different preferences, different styles. There's no judgment in the word different. Different is the key word to this third position. And there's no judgment in it. Like saying, like, hey, you guys are different, isn't saying you're good and you're bad, you're right and you're wrong. Just you guys are different. And now that we have the problem defined as we're different and that's causing a lot of problems, we can start problem solving around it.
I think that sounds really good, and I like that approach. That sounds like an approach for when there's a fairly healthy, functional dynamic going on. I have seen some family businesses that are less than healthy or functional. I'm sure you've seen your share as well of pretty dysfunctional situations. I talked about stonewalling as one example. And I know John Gottman wrote about the Four Horsemen, which I talk about in my book, them being criticism, contempt, defensiveness, and stonewalling. I find sometimes when someone is too far in one of those behaviors that it's really hard to get to that functional place where you can have that, okay, there's, you know, my story, your story, and the truth. Let's just come to the place where we talk about the truth. Because I think at that point, the truth is that one person wants to stonewall it, or one person saying, well, that's not really the truth. That's not really the way it is, or is critical or contemptuous. Like, you know, I mean, just being putting the other person down, simply put. That how could you see it that way? It's clearly not that way. I mean, these are difficult behaviors that get ingrained.
And the people that are doing them may or may not even realize that they're doing them, or maybe they realize they're doing them, but they're not realizing the impact that it's having on the other person. With stonewalling, where someone is saying like, I'm not going to talk about that.
Yeah.
As we said, that's a particularly hard thing because all the communication skills are about talking to somebody by definition. But you can invite them into the conversation at least in better and worse ways, right? So the tendency is to want to say, you know, let's say you send them an email or a text or you call them, or maybe you're in the room with them for a bit. The tendency is to want to launch into it from your point of view and say, look, you really have to talk to me. This is terrible what you're doing. And it's important that we get on the same page and so forth. And, you know, that any of these could work, I suppose. But I think a potentially more effective way of starting a conversation like that is by starting from the other person's point of view and saying, you know, I hear that you strongly don't want to talk about this. And I'm not certain why, but I can imagine that there's possibly a couple different reasons. Maybe, you know, you feel like you've spent enough time on this already, or you just find it emotionally stressful, or you feel like I do things that manipulate you or the conversation, or whatever your reason is. I know that there are good reasons why you don't want to talk, and I respect that. And you know, at the same time, the here's why for me it is important to talk, and here are the things that I feel like we could work through together. And again, at a certain point, it's a matter of just, well, I gave it my best shot. And then the other person has the autonomy to decide whether they're going to take you up on it or not. And as you say, if they don't, then you want to be really clear, like, so here's what's going to happen on my end, you know, right. And then sometimes that's just the best that you can do, which is difficult to accept and sometimes sad, but sometimes true. But I will say that in my consulting work, people will often come to me and say, I've tried to talk to this person, you know, my brother, my dad, my aunt, whoever it is, and they don't want to engage, or they engage in a kind of make-believe way that doesn't really go anywhere. And they'll say, and I've tried everything. And then we talk about it, and it turns out by trying everything, they basically mean I've reached out and I've told them why I'm mad at them. I told them why it's not going to work their way. I told them why they're wrong. Not because the person who's reaching out is trying to do it poorly, but because that's just the way human beings do it. If we're left to our own devices, it's sort of harder and not natural and not always comfortable to reach out and start by trying to empathize with the other person's point of view.
Yeah, I think that is a huge, huge thing, and something I definitely teach my clients, which is first, you have to start with some self-empathy first. Like, wow, this is, you know, really take in, how is it impacting you? You know, how's it making you feel? Really being able to name the feelings, the thoughts that come up, and then have, once you've like think fully empathized for yourself, then you can, I think, empathize for the other person. That's a lot harder. So it's trying to put yourself in their shoes and how do they feel and how is this impacting them? And then approaching the conversation from that place. But the other twist is that I think it's really important to start off with something specific, a specific behavior, a specific action, a specific situation, you know, when you did this, or when you say that, or in this particular situation. What I think one of the problems that happens, I've seen it again in my own family dynamic, is there's a tendency to want to globalize or generalize about, well, you know, we just really can't get along, and you know, and in these situations, and it's just, you know, or we just, something so global that you can't really, you know, that person can't address the problem.
They can't address it. There's no room. So Yeah, I totally agree that people will use words like, you know, when you go and do errands, you never think about me.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, right. And you know, they're using the word never, and they're right. not using it. They're using it sort of thoughtlessly, but the other person's thinking, I don't never think about you. Maybe I think, you know, I think about you a lot. And now you're arguing about whether you think about me how many times. And it's better, as you say, to start with just the specifics, like the last two times that you've gone to the grocery store, you didn't ask me if I wanted anything. And that makes me feel hurt or disappointed. And
yeah.
So it would be great from my point of view if when you go to the store, you could ask me. And I know that sometimes that doesn't make sense, but when it does, that would be important to me. That's part of the piece of it is it's important to me, because the other person might think, yep. Well, you wanted me to get you Cheerios and I didn't ask, so I didn't get you Cheerios. So like, who cares? And if you don't explain why it matters to you, it might be right that like, yeah, well, so you didn't get Cheerios, who cares? But the reason it's important isn't because you don't have the Cheerios, it's because it impacts whether you feel the other person loves you, respects you, cares about you the ways that you care about them, and all these little day-to-day interactions add up to a global sense of how we feel treated and so forth.
You don't care about me, and therefore, you know, this isn't going to work. Right. But I think the other piece that's missing that we can't leave out is when you have to identify your contribution to the issue as well. So like, you know, I used to get that sort of with the Cheerios conversation. Sounds all too familiar. And I'd be like, you know what? I'm really sorry. I'm not that good about writing things, the food that needs to get purchased on the list. And so it doesn't work.
That's a great example, John. And so let's say you say to your partner, you went to the market, I wanted Cheerios, but you didn't even take a moment to ask me if I want anything.
Right.
And then the other person says, well, you know that I keep a list and you didn't put Cheerios on there.
Right.
And now we could frame that as, well, so whose fault is it then? And I'm going to say, look, I don't care about your list. Like, it's your fault for not asking. Yeah. And you're going to say, no, it's your fault for not putting Cheerios on the list.
Right.
And in fact, as is so often the case, both of those things are true, right? Like, I mm-hmm. could put Cheerios on the list and I'm not. So that's my contribution to this dispute, is that I'm not doing that. And if I own up to that, that's helpful. And your contribution is that you're not asking me, you know, on your way out. When you look at your own contribution to a problem, a lot of people think like, well, I don't want to talk about what I could have done better because like that'll put me in a weaker position. But in fact, it's a strong position to be in, because the more you understand about what you're contributing to a problem, the more power you have to change it, because you can often change your own contributions unilaterally. I'm thinking of another family example. You know, my mother, when she was getting older, would say, well, we don't talk enough. We don't talk enough. And I'm thinking, well, we talk a lot. And so the problem is just my mother wants to talk too much. And she would say, Doug doesn't want to talk enough. And finally, I realized one of my contributions to this problem was that the only times that we talked was when she would call me.
Mm-hmm.
And if I simply called her, even at the same rate, so we weren't talking more often, but just by me calling her, it put a whole different frame around our conversations, because she was like, oh, sometimes I call Doug and sometimes he calls me, and that feels good to both. That feels good to her, especially. And that was great. So by being able to identify, well, what am I contributing to this? It sometimes just gives you the unilateral ability to fix the whole thing. Not always, but certainly sometimes.
Yeah. I think, again, it gets back to that indicating your willingness to want to resolve the problem at hand, and whether it's on a whether it's just specific to that particular behavior that you guys are talking about, or a more global behavior, which I imagine is having then a series of conversations like this around the handful or whatever, or the many things that we each do that contributes to the degradation of the relationship. And then you really have to express your desire to repair, to heal. That's a really hard thing to do, I think, for some people. I believe that some families are too far gone and they're not willing to get to that, like, yes, there is no yes, where they both say yes. And by the way, I'm sure you've heard this phrase. I mean, an insurance guy once told me, the definition of a good deal is where, like, both parties, and a real estate broker could say this too, in a house sale, the definition of a good deal is where both parties are equally neither of them are happy with the way the deal happened, but they can both live with it the way it was done. I mean, it's like, really? That's getting to yes? That doesn't sound like a great outcome. That sounds like a compromise.
If you ask a group of people who negotiate, like, what's the definition of a good outcome?
Yeah.
In a negotiation, that's one of the ones that will come up. And, you know, other ones are like, well, a good outcome is when I crush the other side and I do great. Another one is we're both equally unhappy with the deal.
Right.
And the equally part of that is good. Like, that's probably what makes it a deal, is you both feel like, well, I didn't like this deal, but they didn't either, so that feels about fair. But the unhappy part is not so great, right? So in my work, we try to find ways just to shift that to, we both feel equally happy, or we both feel happy enough that it's going to work. And that's a matter of sort of finding some of the joint gains that can come from negotiation. We often think of negotiation just as zero sum head to head, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
A dollar for you is a dollar less for me. And that's true on some issues, right? But often you can find ways to maximize the joint pie that you're dividing.
I think that's what, you know, I mean, there was this whole movement a number of years ago, maybe decades ago, about win-win negotiations, win-win. And I mean, ultimately, that was always my perspective, that we want to try and figure out ways to make things win-win. But the truth is, it's not always that case. And so
that's true. Yeah. So I teach negotiation, and my students will say, okay, so and we teach this win-win approach, right? Mm-hmm. And the students will say, well, this is great if I happen to negotiate against someone who took this course also. And so we're doing like win-win negotiation, but 99% of the people that I'm going to negotiate against in the real world won't have taken this course, and they might be doing a win-lose negotiation. So what we talk about is, how do you modify the win-win skills such that it works, or at least gives you the best shot at working with somebody who has a totally different mindset. And there's a number of things that you can do. And the main one is just being aware that whatever the other person says, you can say anything you want. You don't have to follow their script or play their game. If they say, like, you know, let's say you're selling, let's say they're selling a house, and they say, well, the price is $500,000, take it or leave it. A lot of people think, well, now what am I going to do? I have to either accept it or leave it. And instead, you can at least propose to change the game and say, look, you're doing a take it or leave it offer, and that ends up putting pressure on me to say yes or no. And we could both lose a deal that might be good for both of us if we do it that way. I would propose that we look at, you know, comparables and other interests that we might discuss and see if we can come up with something that works for both of us. And, you know, they're allowed to say, no, $500,000, take it or leave it. But at least you're trying to change the game. You're explicitly saying, you're playing this game. I think we're both better off playing this other game.
Gotcha. All right. So maybe one kind of final topic is, so you've been invited in. You're the consultant. I'm sure this happens many times. And the person who calls you in says, I'm not happy with this, you know, with this other party that I'm negotiating with. And now the other party thinks, oh, Doug or Doug's team, whatever, this consulting firm, they have an inherent bias. They've been hired by this opposing party. And so how is this going to work in my favor?
As you've described it, it probably isn't. So when we get called into a dispute, let's say it's two siblings in a family business, and one of the siblings calls us, sibling A calls us, the first thing that we talk about, like, what's the dispute, what's going on, but then they say, so that's why we need to hire you as mediator or a facilitator. And the first thing we'll talk about is, well, what does your sibling think about that? And if they say, well, they're totally on board, they looked at your website, they're all in, I say, that's great. More likely they say, oh, well, we haven't talked to them yet. And then what I do is I say, okay, so here's what I would recommend. I'm going to put this call, we're going to pause this conversation for a while. And what I want you to do is see if your sibling will talk to me. And really what I'm doing in that conversation is I'm going to explain that while you got in touch with me, the second sibling, I'm really going to talk to the second sibling first. Mm-hmm. And get the details of their point of view. And I'm also going to say, and by the way, your sibling contacted me, and that might make you feel like I'm therefore on your sibling's side. To the extent you feel that, let's discuss that also. And let's discuss whether there are ways we can mitigate that, whether it's a matter of like who's paying me or what the, you know, just what the setup is. So I want to admit, this comes from having made the mistake two or three times where I get like far into it with one sibling and I'm like, wow, I really get this conflict. And they sometimes are able to get the other sibling to come, but the other sibling's not trusting and is starting off in a negative space, and justifiably so. It's like, I've spent a lot of time with one sibling and like, who am I? Mm-hmm. So you do that a couple times, you realize it crashes and burns, and then you have to kind of find a way to bring the second sibling in earlier and address whatever legitimate concerns they have.
Yeah. Well, interesting, Doug. Difficult conversations, especially when stakes are high, certainly a challenging area. I know that some people might just think all of this sounds kind of very fluffy, very like, you know, like this is just about basically having conversations, but so much of life and so much of doing business is about communication, and we run into problems. I see it more often than not in family businesses. I'm sure you do as well, or in negotiations and in the sale or purchase of or transfer of an asset. I think that's it's a very interesting thing. So I think that something that you offer, I have as well, is some tools that are available so that people can start with maybe framing it up. I really like my 60-second critical conversation framework. I have a tool, an example. It helps people to think through how to deliver a difficult conversation and get to the other side. But it's just interesting that some people will probably never want to even look or listen to, you know, talking about this subject because it just seems so like, come
it's
on,
like, this is like fluffy or touchy, like this, yeah,
or like this. So, isn't this obvious? Like, you know, or you know, so
yeah. Well, so So I hear that a lot also from like both strangers and then actually people that I'm working with. Mm-hmm. And what I would say is, there, you know, there, if you have a way of doing things that's like tough and clear and assertive, and it's and aggressive maybe, and it's working, then you don't have a problem. You probably don't even need to be talking to me if it's really working. By learning these other skills that are a little more nuanced and take some thought, you're not removing anything that you're able to do. Like if you want to be assertive or threaten somebody, you can still do that. It's not like I'm taking away your ability to do that. So you retain all the skills that you have, all the methods that you have, and we're just adding some new ones. And particularly when people are in a, some kind of loggerhead or stonewall or some kind of disruptive behavior that is negative as opposed to positive, like you put, that's when the skills that they've been relying on their whole lives and that have often worked have sort of come to the end of the road, or they just don't match with this conflict, or they don't work in this case. And so just continuing to try to force them to work isn't going to help. And what might help is trying these other set of skills that, you know, maybe they're fluffy, maybe they're touchy-feely. You know, all the biggest companies in the world are teaching all their people these skills. So there's lots of success in the business world, in the military, and, you know, in traditionally sort of arenas that are considered not fluffy.
Well, I think what also people need to understand is if you're dealing with a difficult employee, and if there's a generation or two gap between you and that employee, I mean, this is really instructive for you to look at what are the alternative ways to communicate with this person. Because like everyone sort of knows millennials, which is like the new workforce that's starting to dominate the landscape in terms of demographics. They have a different way of communicating. They have a different set of needs than baby boomers, for example. So, and the command and control leadership sort of, you know, my way or the highway approach, that's really gone by the wayside years ago in exchange for maybe more consensus, more, I don't want to use the word, but I will, democratic approaches to decision-making. You need to understand that the generation gap has changed. And so you might not have the tools or the language or the approach that is going to work when there's a generational gap.
It's a really prevalent problem, or not a problem in the sense of that one group or the other is doing something wrong, but just that it's creating challenges. And that's a great example as a sort of tail end baby boomers that you and I both are. Speaking for myself, I'll observe that when one of the younger people comes into the company and they see things differently, I'm thinking, hey, you know, I'm 63. Like I know how this is supposed to work because I've been doing it and you haven't. But that's kind of ridiculous. Like there, I mean, obviously having had experiences is useful, but there's no like if someone says, well, we, you know, I want feedback on a, you know, three times a year. And I'm thinking, we're a small company. We're not giving feedback. We just give you feedback if we're working on something together, but we're not going to do formal feedback. What I'm thinking is, because that's what worked for me, that doesn't mean it's going to work for a generation that was raised under, you know, different assumptions and different experiences, different fears, different hopes. And so that's where the difficult conversation comes in of understanding them, listening, trying to engage, and sharing your perspective as well.
Okay, sounds good. All right, we're going to wrap this with, make it a simple layup type question relating to the beginning of the show. Who's your favorite basketball player of all time, Doug?
Oh, gosh. When you and I were kids, I would have said Walt Frazier.
Right.
He had a good head fake, too. Now I would say Larry Bird, because that when I was in the 80s, I lived in Boston, and he was the big star in Boston, and that was, and I met him once or twice, not really, but I, you know, said hi. So that was fun. How about, who's your favorite?
Okay, all right. So having lived in Los Angeles for the last number of years that you've lived in Cambridge, I would have to say Magic Johnson. And I actually did play with him once or twice at the sports club, fancy sports club in LA. And the funny thing was, is that I had to guard him in a full court game. And I shot from so far out of my range that I missed the hoop altogether. I couldn't even see the rim shooting over him. So,
you were guarding him on defense?
Yeah, it was ridiculous. And I'm embarrassed to say that he had just been recently diagnosed as HIV positive, and nobody really knew enough to want to say, okay, well, I'll guard him. I mean, everyone was kind of, they didn't know enough about HIV and whether it could be just spread through touch or stuff. So I didn't guard him that tight.
But see, if you had guarded him tight, you would have locked him down. He wouldn't have scored.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, hopefully, folks, you had a little bit of fun and you've learned something. And more importantly, I really believe that tools help to set us free, because it can allow us, the use of them can allow us to see a new behavior. And I know I have a tool available, but Doug has tools available that are downloadable from his website. The link will be in the show notes. Doug, thanks so much for spending this hour with me.
And my pleasure. It's great to see you again. And maybe we'll reunite on the basketball court one of these days.
Sounds good. All right.
This podcast is sponsored by myself, Jonathan Goldhill, and my company, the Goldhill Group, where we provide coaching for growing companies. I'm Jonathan Goldhill, and my purpose is simple: to guide entrepreneurial leaders in family businesses towards more freedom and fulfillment. I want entrepreneurs to get clarity around the changes that will make them and their businesses more successful, so they can experience the same freedom I've enjoyed in my life. Our proven practices challenge business owners to think differently about their business and how they're running it, and quite literally become game changers in our clients' companies. Learn more at the goldhillgroup.com website, where you can schedule your free strategy session. Thank you for joining us on the Disruptive Successor Podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, please subscribe, review, and share with a friend who would benefit from the message. If you're interested in picking up a copy of my book, Disruptive Successor, go to disruptivesuccessor.com.